Malcolm Hoenlein is in Jerusalem. Malcolm Hoenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Malcolm, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. From very sunny Jerusalem, where there's no rain and no wind, and just beautiful sunshine. And I want to give a mazel tov to Hanoch and Alana Hoenlein in Baltimore on the engagement of their daughter, Michal, to Emil Tichbertich from Paris, now Maryland, and they should build a bais nema. I'm also related to them.
You certainly are, and how appropriate that we start this conversation with good news, with a mazel tov. Isn't that what the Jewish people are always about, being able to rebound and concentrate on the positive, on the good things? Malcolm, obviously a very challenging week. You were there. You continue to be there, obviously. Rabbi Zinger, the Rosh HaYeshiva of Mekor HaChaim, during the eulogy on Tuesday, mentioned the tongue-in-cheek Jewish adage about there being two Jews and three opinions, but he added, in a non-tongue-in-cheek manner, he added, but one heart. Did you in fact feel that one heart during your visit this week?
I was there at the funeral, and I went early in order to be able to be there, and was seated right behind the Prime Minister and the families, and could watch their reaction and see the not only the loving care that was demonstrated to them, but the strength and the determination and the confidence that they had, the families had. Obviously, there were points where they broke down and the only natural reactions. But I heard Rabbi Singer's words and the words of Netanyahu, which was very strong and poignant, as were the others. There weren't that many speeches. But the hardest part, I have to tell you, was when three fathers stood up together to say Kaddish. And I will tell you that there certainly wasn't a dry eye amongst the tens and tens and tens of thousands. I have organized big rallies, and I know that, you know, what it takes to get 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. This had to be close to 100,000. Just an endless stream. For a kilometer or 2 kilometers, you could see just masses of people coming out after the funeral. It took almost an hour to get out of the area in Modi'in where the three were buried, and that's after they had the individual ceremonies for each of the three boys.
You alluded to this, of course, over the last couple of weeks when you noted that there were no demands being made by the kidnappers, which, you know, obviously did not bode well. If they have nothing of value, then, you know, then they would hesitate to make any demands. And obviously, based on what we know now, authorities concluded 99% that the boys were gone almost immediately. Would you think that the families were informed about this very early on? I mean, was it days before authorities gave them their impression of what their fate was, or is this something that they knew within hours?
They didn't know within hours because, you know, within hours they just started the investigation. But when they found the car and they found the glasses of one of the boys and it was taken in the middle of the night to an optician who identified it, there were other things that they found, obviously blood in the cars, that they knew that there were bad things that happened. They didn't know the ultimate fate because they didn't have the bodies. But you know that one of the fathers said on the third day he wrote the hesped for his son already because he knew the truth.
And then we know that, and just for a moment we'll concentrate on the mothers, that the mothers travel to Geneva and the mothers are going to these rallies and are encouraging people during the Tehillim and prayer sessions to keep going and not lose faith. And all of this that you just mentioned was in the back of their minds as this was going on.
All of this and much more, knowing, you know, fearing what the boys went through. You know, they're in the hands of barbaric monsters who are capable of doing anything and have done in the past terrible things that to people they've held captive. So their reaction and their focus on Achdut, on trying to promote the unity of the Jewish people in the midst of all of this, and their constant admonitions to people to sustain the faith and to demonstrate it in different ways was all the more remarkable. I spoke to them at the funeral, very briefly, obviously, but you saw that same confidence there. And you know, one of the mothers fell on the stretcher. The bodies were carried on stretchers because they're not buried in coffins in Jerusalem. And, you know, these were all natural reactions, but the incredible strength that they demonstrated, not only through the week, but at the funeral itself, with the bodies laying in front, three gurneys of very slight bodies, you could see that, it was superhuman. And I have to tell you, to remain composed during that ceremony was impossible. And when I landed, in fact, on the airplane in Tel Aviv, as they touched down, you know that every Israeli takes out their phone right away.
Right.
So they turned on their phones, and you could hear the phones ringing, literally at a wave across the airplane. And then you heard people going, oh, no, and sobbing started. And almost a crescendo was reached as the plane taxied to the gate, because by then it had been confirmed. When we landed, it was only an Al Jazeera report, and in the 10 minutes till we got to the gate, obviously Israeli press was reporting it, and people were getting it on their phones, and there was hardly a dry eye in the plane. Everybody just quietly walked off the plane. Nobody talked. Nobody laughed. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of us didn't realize how engaged we were in the entire story until we heard the news and saw what emotions emerged from us.
Right.
Malcolm Honlein from Jerusalem. How lucky, maybe the wrong word, but you know what I mean. How lucky is it that the bodies were found? I mean, this could have gone on forever, right?
This could have gone on, and you know how it was found. It was found by volunteers from the area, Jewish volunteers who were combing it, because it had been an area checked by the police. They did not see it. They noticed that there was a tree that was not a natural tree for that area, that it seemed both in location and where it's standing was artificial, and they went out to check it, and they saw that at the bottom there were stones, and that's how they found the body.
Some people found it unusual that the parents requested that the boys all be buried side by side. Does that also reflect the unity and the struggle that the families had been through, and they, you know, concluded that there was no other way to end this story?
And to have everybody come together in one place after having the ceremonies in each of their communities, the idea of having them all together so they could be buried together, having gone through what they did, even if for a short time, hopefully, is again a sign of their incredible dedication and devotion, and then their wisdom to see beyond the moment and to rise above their own pain, to think about how they could serve the state and the Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, by having one place where this mass of people could come together. People walked many kilometers because you couldn't get near the area by car, young and old alike, many kilometers, in order to be there. And I think that was the vision, that there would be one ceremony to show that there's a common pain, that we're all part of one family. And I hope we can find ways to sustain the kind of reaction where there were thousands of events in the United States. You know, people wanted one big rally, and I told them it's much more powerful that this occasion, because it wasn't a political message that we were trying to get out. It was a prayer. It was unity. That there were thousands of events across the United States and around the world held in support of the boys and their families, I think was the most magnificent demonstration possible.
What did you think of the speakers list at some of the funerals before the one, you know, big gathering? Some people were shocked that someone like Yair Lapid was asked to speak. What was your impression of that?
People were shocked, I can tell you. The political people, you know, I spoke to, I only saw the one where Bogi Yaalon, because I had just come in and was preparing to go to the funeral at Modi'in. But Yair Lapid and the Minister of Education, Piron, both of whom are somewhat ideologically different than maybe where the families came from. But first of all, they're not all of the same view, and
right.
they wanted to show again that this is not one segment of the political spectrum or one segment of the Jewish people, but that they all be represented there to show that this is a approach of Klal Yisrael.
And it's amazing. You just said so many people don't realize how not everybody's on the same page in this entire group of people, and yet never a word about politics, never a word about an individual, a movement, a party, a policy, a direction Israel should or should not take, blaming one or the other in, you know, from the past or present policies for this entire episode. I mean, what discipline they had to completely remain away from that stuff.
That, you're absolutely right, but and they went even further, that they took every opportunity, even at the funeral, to thank the police, the IDF, the volunteers, everyone who was involved, and did not point any fingers and say if you had done this or if somebody else had done something else. Not even against the police, where there is an investigation ongoing for the delay in the response.
Yeah, I know, and people already were disciplined for that, right?
Yes.
It's funny, you talk about the unity, and it obviously was the topic of conversation over the last 3 weeks, this incredible unity. And we had Dov Lipman on. We were discussing the whole thing. And, you know, I proposed, and this is something that you and I have discussed in the past. If we could just start, and I have to do the same thing. I'm not shirking my responsibility. If we could just start with a really harsh rhetoric being eliminated, you know, not asking people to change their opinions or not be passionate about their point of view. But when you hear people say, oh, that one is destroying Judaism, or that party on the right or left is, you know, taking us in a horrible direction, or that one doesn't care about the future of the Jewish people. It's those type of statements. We can eliminate those based on the unity of the last couple of weeks. That would be a tremendous victory.
It would be very nice if people would think about the consequences of their words and their deeds. I don't know who was responsible for killing the Palestinian, but it certainly is a supporter of Hamas, because that acted more for Hamas and for distracting people's attention from this dastardly act regarding the three boys, and put everything on a moral equivalency. Again, it could be purely an internal fight, and there are many rumors, and I've spoken to police, but the fear is that this will have been a nationalistic event. That we have to consider what rhetoric, what gave license to this kind of an action. This is so un-Jewish and so contrary to all of our values. And the idea that today, when we could come together in such a remarkable way to remind us that what we have in common far outweighs our differences, and that only by coming together can we hope to secure everyone's future. We can't afford, with the challenges that Israel faces today, and, you know, in the 2 days I'm here, I've had meetings, and we'll have, you know, a number more before I come back, with the leaders of Israel. There are so many issues right now, whether it's ISIS and the changing map of the Middle East, the security situation in Gaza, the security situation in the north, so many threats, the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, the Islamist extremists who are training in Syria and going to the United States and Europe and elsewhere in the world. When we realize all of this, you know that we have limited resources. And it's only by applying all those resources in a constructive and meaningful way. And it doesn't mean that everybody has to believe the same thing, and it doesn't mean they can't criticize. But you got to think of the consequences and what words you use and how you give expression to it.
Right. I gotta go back for a second, because I and I'm sure others are confused. Are you saying that there's a definitive report now that that Arab boy was killed at the hands of Jews?
No, there's no definitive report yet of anything. I said that there are some signs indicating that, because there are other things in terms of family feuds and stuff that, you know, we've seen before, where, you know, Arabs killed Arabs and they killed women, they killed men. And that there was some incident with a cousin of this boy, and he comes from a very big clan in the area. So there's that possibility. But I said it doesn't matter who did it. Whoever they are a supporter of Hamas, because they're benefiting Hamas
right.
for what they did.
Do you know when the results of that investigation will be released?
Well, the body's being released now. There's a rioting going on in East Jerusalem and areas. Near the Temple Mount and elsewhere, the destruction in certain isolated areas, especially of the light railroad stop in Arab areas were completely destroyed, set on fire. They've been clashing with police almost nonstop, large numbers. They've attacked individuals, Jews who they and people who they thought were Jews but turned out not to be. And so as of now, we do not know. Today, the body is being released for the funeral, and then the police will release the information from the study. Because the body was burned, it took much longer to do the forensic testing that they need to do.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, and around the world on the web, jmandam.org. Friday morning on this 4th of July, let us remember that we are privileged to be living in a country that's free and one that has democratic values. Before we move on to what we got to talk about, Israeli reaction militarily, which we will in a moment, what about other types of reaction? Were you dissatisfied with the way the White House dealt with this whole episode and even the way they responded after the three bodies were found?
Well, I think the White House and Israel cooperated in Israel, and they offered, you know, any assistance to Israel. But the public statements, I think, were wanting. And especially to after the bodies were found, to right away say that both sides should exercise restraint, as if both sides have some responsibility in the death of the three boys who are not engaged in anything. And the headlines constantly referred to three settlers, three settler youths, because that has some connotation as justification for their deaths, because they are, quote, settlers. That was not from the administration, that from the media.
Right.
But the fact that they could have waited, you know, a few hours and issued a separate statement about the responsibilities of both sides, I think it would have had much more of an impact than people have, you know, deluged us with criticisms of the administration's statements.
And it seemed that Secretary...
The Israelis here have not been that critical.
It seems that Secretary of State Kerry was very anxious to get out there after the killing of this Arab boy that we just spoke about, without even having results of the investigation.
Right. And I guess he has other agendas as well.
And the other thing is rabbinic and Jewish leadership reaction. I don't know what infuriates me more. When people use this opportunity to insist that now we see that only a two-state solution is the only solution as the funeral is going on, or rabbinic leaders who insist on telling us why these three boys were killed and end up blaming their parents for it. From right to left, I think there are some, there should be strong suggestions that it's sometimes better to keep one's mouth shut.
These are very disturbing, and I think things that will have to be addressed in the future. The idea that people use it for political purposes and to diminish the moment when we should be coming together to mourn and to either put blame or responsibility because these young boys were learning in yeshiva in a certain area or in any other reason that they could give, or to advocate. I mean, right now, people advocating a two-state solution, I think, would see themselves as facing many counter-arguments given the ISIS activities, et cetera, and the developments in Gaza, as saying that this is the moment is not mature and right, given what the PA is up to, what all the things, and thinking that if, in fact, that had been an area where of autonomy at a time like this, where Hamas might have emerged victorious and linked up with ISIS in Iraq, it's not a far distance, it's just across Jordan, with very few protections in between, this would have changed the whole map of the Middle East.
Yeah.
I mean, and Israel would be facing Iran on its borders, something that's still possible, and Jordan is certainly seen as the most vulnerable target right now, and could be a prime target for the Jordan, not necessarily to take it over, but to establish themselves and to spread the, quote, caliphate, which, you know, we talked about from the very beginning, and that this was the goal, and look how they have moved.
Yeah, sort of like Lebanon, right, where they may not officially have always been in control, but where their dominance is obvious.
Well, not this group particularly, but the fact that Iraq has collapsed, that the army of Iraq has collapsed, that Maliki, who over the years has been a puppet of the Iranians, and is now exposed for his incompetence and for his one-sidedness and people taking revenge on all sides in these issues.
Right.
And you see the radicalization of population, Sunni, Shiite, as people are being mobilized to fight for and against the other sides in this situation.
Yeah, I didn't say
people
that.
People might say that it's in Israel's interest that all these guys kill each other, but you have to think also about what the outcome will be and whether that will be in Israel's interest.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting that they are Hezbollah, but I was just comparing them to Hezbollah and what had happened.
About the activities. They,
right.
That is the model. They
right.
say that that's the model.
Right, exactly. All right, so let's start with Gaza. You know, we kept saying that we'll speak to you on Friday and find out if it's going to be a rough summer in Israel. Looks like we're heading in that direction, although, of course, we pray for the safety and security of all IDF soldiers who can be involved in any of these missions. I don't even know if the Prime Minister knows the answer to this question right now, but I'll ask you anyway. What is the Israeli response going to be on the border with Gaza? Is it going to be similar to what we've seen over the last couple of days, or is it going to escalate where, in fact, this is going to be an even more challenging summer?
I think the Prime Minister has put down very clear markers about what he expects from Hamas, and they gave him 24 hours to end the fight and then end the rockets. Yesterday, I know there were 30 rockets, and then during the night there were more. Some of them hit homes, which is a red line, an absolute red line. Israel has retaliated against multiple sites inside Gaza, which they know were military sites. But the truth is that you can't root it out unless you have troops on the ground going in after these locations underneath hospitals and inside underneath mosques and in people's homes where they store these rockets. They don't mind putting civilians in harm's way. And you cannot look at it in isolation from all the other things that are going on.
Right.
So the battle with Hamas is engaged right now. I think that the fight over the 50,000 employees that Abbas has ordered back to work, those are Fatah employees in Gaza, while 50,000 Hamas employees are without work and are getting no compensation for him all along. He paid 70,000 people not to work for years in Gaza, the whole civil service infrastructure. So now that's another source of tension and clash between the Palestinians, between Abbas and Hamas. And he has threatened to break the deal if they prove that that Hamas was behind the killing of the three boys or the abduction of the three boys. And it doesn't mean that they have to have carried it out. It means that they incited, that they inspired, and the concept process of incitement is a subject that I hope will get more attention now. So the situation in Gaza, where there are tens of thousands of missiles, and despite the fact that a lot of the infrastructure has been hit, a lot remains. And it's like one massive military depot.
What about this truce that we keep reading about? Israel, Hamas, Egypt, what's that all about?
Well, Israel pulled out of it. I mean, there was a ceasefire agreement, but Hamas, like always, has violated constantly. There have been attempts to place IEDs along the roads, there are attempts to lure, and remember, there were 60 attempts to kidnap people, including soldiers, since January of last year. So, unfortunately, this time it succeeded, but it's not because they haven't been trying all along to do it.
Right, but in terms of this activity this week by Israel, there are rumors about Egypt brokering some type of truce between Hamas and the Israelis. Is that even possible?
Yes, there are reports that they're trying to broker a ceasefire. You know, Mubarak did it several times also. This doesn't need to be brokered. This needs a determination by Hamas that they're going to go after those who are firing it. Then they'll say, well, it's not our people, it's Islamic Jihad. They're in charge, they're responsible.
And in terms of the battle against Hamas in the Judean Hills, are they going to find these two kidnappers?
A lot of resources are being devoted. They know who they're looking for. They've demolished the homes of the two. And then you see the criticism of that when we know that it's, in fact, an effective deterrent there, and you have very few that really worked, because Israel doesn't execute those responsible. They put them in prison and then release them, as most democracies do, even after many years. And the demolition of the house is something that can be a really important deterrent, because these guys don't want to see that even if they go off to jail and live off the state, the families will pay a price as well.
Right.
So the criticism of it to me is almost irrational. It seems to me a very effective way.
As you sat in meetings this week, what was the evaluation? I don't even know what you're allowed to reveal, but what was the evaluation of this whole operation in the Judean Hills in the last 2.5 weeks? I mean, did they accomplish what they wanted to accomplish? They eradicate Hamas cells to the degree they would have liked to in the Judean Hills?
Well, first of all, it's not over. And second, it was very effective because they were able to move quickly against the infrastructure of Hamas and essentially dismantle it. And Abbas, again, should be thanking them and praising them, so should the world. But they've arrested many of the key operatives, including people released for at the time of the Shalit deal. I think that it's generally seen as been effective. There was a limited ability at that point to detect exactly where they were, because a lot of caves, it's a very difficult terrain. And as I said, it was actually volunteers who located the actual site where the bombs were. So the international community has not rallied against what Israel's done. They've told Israel, do it with restraint. But you see, even some of the European leaders were pretty supportive of Israel doing what it had to do in regard to the three boys.
The Prime Minister of Great Britain released a pretty supportive statement.
The Prime Minister of Great Britain, as you know, Canada is always supportive and wants a few others. But at the same time, the same Europeans who were issuing statements were announcing that they were encouraging or passing directives to businessmen not to do business with the settlements in the West Bank. I mean, this is such a distortion, and such a warped approach that you punish the people there, many of whom are employing Palestinians, by the way. And they're telling them not to do business. They don't tell them not to do business with all these places where hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people each year are being killed around the world, and nobody puts out directives. But against the settlements of housing units in the West Bank, then it becomes a subject for the BDS and for the boycott movement.
Is it unreasonable for us to demand of our American public officials, members of the United States Senate, members of the United States House of Representatives, to demand that Washington stop funding the Palestinian Authority as long as Hamas continues to be part of that group?
There is. First of all, there were members of Congress here, including very influential ones like Alana Ross Layton and Ted Deutch, ranking Democrat and Republicans in the subcommittee. But the House Appropriations Committee approved the operation bill that bars aid to the PA from $440 million in proposed funding. That the Senate version of the Foreign Ops Bill, Foreign Operations Bill, includes similar language, was approved, I think, in mid-June by the Senate Appropriations Committee. And this year's language targets any type of power-sharing government that, as I think the language here was, results from an agreement with Hamas. And it imposes quite strict conditions under which the administration can waive the funding ban. And it says that the funding for the Palestinians is off the table until it's clear that unity government is committed to peace and security. And Kay Granger, who's the chair of the committee from Texas, used those words in asserting the purpose of the action. So Congress has moved very clearly now. Israel, I think, is withholding its aid that was due this week at the beginning of the month for the Palestinians, and we'll have to see yet what decision they make about the future funding, because some of it goes toward security forces, and they need them to be there and to be cooperative.
Is it a true account that as ambulances were taking the bodies out of that area where they were found, that in fact they were being stoned, those ambulances were being stoned by Arabs during that trip?
During which trip?
When they were taking the bodies out by ambulance from the area where they were found to, I guess, where they would be prepared for burial, that those ambulances were actually stoned by Arabs?
Yes, they were, and they knew what was in the ambulances as they departed, because they saw the rush of responsive security personnel to the area, and as they pulled out, they were stoned. But there were many incidents of stoning in the area over the last couple of days.
Yeah.
And now much more extreme violence, you know, being perpetrated using the death of the young Palestinian as a cover for what it clearly is planned, not spontaneous responses.
When your meetings this week are not focusing on Gaza, I assume they are focusing on what's happening in neighboring countries, which you alluded to earlier, ISIS, etc. I know for people like me, it's difficult to sift through everything and understand all the sides and what direction Israel should take. What about Israeli leadership? Is there any more clarity now in terms of either who they should be supporting or what type of governments they should be trying to help in these cases? I mean, should they be helping the government of Jordan? Should they be supporting the established government of Iraq? What should Israel be doing right now?
Well, first of all, you're right about the panoply of issues. I mean, remember, we also faced the July 20th deadline with Iran.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And the Iran negotiations, plus more, which is weighing very heavily on the minds of Israel, and would be, I'd say, the priority issue, a longer-term issue beyond the issues of the moment. But if you look, Israel is strongly advocating for Jordan to assure the stability of Jordan, which is important for Israel, it's important for the PA, it's important for Jordan, it's important for the region. The collapse of the Jordanian regime, the Jordanian government, would put Iran on Israel's border. It would unleash forces with 1.5 million Syrians, with the other refugees there, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the Palestinian population being two-thirds of Jordan. You could have untold consequences. Israel is also seemingly supporting more autonomy, if not independence, for the Kurds. This is a big story that gets underplayed, but this is one of the things that could remain after things settle down, if they ever do, that could change the whole Middle East. The ISIS, I think, can't sustain long-term holding it if they're facing really organized and intelligent opposition, and they should be going after their supply routes and their backing in Syria, but they're recruiting more people. ISIS is not such a big group. The estimates are that maybe 7,000 to 15 or 20,000 max of support, but they're getting now recruits from all over the world because people, these extremists, driven by extremist ideologies who are looking for a place, who were initially recruited to fight in Syria, are now fighting with ISIS, which is seen as the vanguard for the establishment of this caliphate and the other activities that it's talking about. All of this exacerbating the Sunni-Shiite tensions in the region. And this could be a very critical factor, but the Kurds, you see Turkey's position now has changed in supporting now some sort of Turkish independence, but you have to know that there's an August 10th election, and the Kurds could well be the kingmakers in who gets elected president. So Erdogan is now wooing them, and in the hope that he will get their votes, and that will be the difference, because he's running neck and neck with the opposition, and I think many of the analysts say the decision will be made by how the Kurdish vote goes. There are 12 million Kurds in Turkey. So the move towards establishing a Kurdish independent area again erase the borders. You know, I challenge people to tell me, where is the border today between Iraq and Syria?
So if we see Erdogan, for instance, calling for, you know, Kurdish autonomy, it's simply a political ploy to make sure he gets their votes.
It's absolutely a political maneuver right now for himself. And we see how the Kurds are using the threat of independence to obtain the best possible deal for staying in Iraq. You know, they have some of the oil areas. They've been selling oil. A lot of issues we can't go into, but, I mean, it's very complex subjects, and you have to see how the people, the residents in these different countries, how they will be treated. What will Iran do, which fears very much an independent Kurdish state, because it goes from Iran, Turkey, Syria, Iraq. You have large numbers of Kurds in all of these areas, and they also have close ties to Israel.
And which border challenge did you just issue? Iraq, Syria, you said? To Iraq, Syria. That would be the challenge. So interesting, toward the beginning of what you were just saying, what we've learned is that arguably Israel's most peaceful border, potentially, if we don't play Jordan right and if Iran moves the way we think they might, could become its most troubling border. Because you'd have to say arguably the least, the most peaceful border right now is with Jordan, right? Essentially.
Obviously it's with Jordan.
Right. And God forbid, if Iran does what you just described, it could become the biggest border problem for Israel.
It could be, and that's why Israel has been very supportive and why they have been encouraging the West to be supportive of the king and his military so they can defend themselves. But Israel's border with Lebanon has been relatively quiet,
right.
And even the Syrian border, if there's a retaliated, relatively quiet.
Right, but because of
it
the extension,
there are no incidents.
Right, but because of the extension from Syria, I don't think we'd ever label it as quiet. We're always worried that anything could happen in a moment up there.
And the same thing is true though with Jordan.
I mean, yeah.
The same thing is true in all these areas. When you look at the polls, 90% of Jordanians do not support close relations with Israel or. The numbers in, and the incitement in, against the within the populations against Israel, against the closeness to Israel, very strong. It's not to be dismissed about what the implications of that is.
And finally, tell us about that deal with Iran. The United States has to do what in the next couple of weeks?
Have to reach an agreement. July 20th is the deadline of the 6 months set for it. There is a provision to extend it for 6 months. They say, well, we'll do it unless they've made sufficient progress. I had a briefing night before last from a top White House official here who called me, and you know I don't see anything that has radically changed except that the number of centrifuges may be much higher. This is something that will be very unacceptable to Israel and should be unacceptable to the U.S. They point out that the storage capacities are less. In other words, they don't have they've set the limit on how much you could store, but. Frankly, it is not relevant anymore because the new centrifuges, they have not taken any out. It's true they haven't added any and replaced them, but they have 19,000 centrifuges in place, including a couple thousand of the most modern, and those can move directly towards enrichment at the level needed for a weapon. So the storage is not that important. And the question is, what happens with the missile capacity? What happens with the weaponization, the military? We haven't even heard the discussions of those things. So the question will be, will they extend it 6 months till the next 6 months? What will they do in terms of easing sanctions?
Right.
You know, the argument is given that the sanctions have continued to be impactful and the economy is down, inflation is 30%, et cetera, and yet we hear of seminars given for European businessmen about that are packed with major corporations' representatives, discussing about how you get back in business in Iran
to invest in Iran, right? Encouraging people to invest there,
to do business,
right? Unbelievable.
Even though some of the fears, you know, the car sales haven't gone up, the many other things that people thought might happen because of the change in the sanctions regime till now, and the sanctions continue to be applied, and they do have an impact, but what we have to do is see more of it and not a weakening of the sanctions, and to see the united front from the powers, and that would include also about their meddling in Iraq, their support for international terrorism, their human rights violations. You know, time is running out. There isn't much time for such a complicated deal. They claim that the world should simply trust them. It ignores the fact that for 20 years, 15 years, there are dozens of violations by Iran of its international non-proliferation obligations and responsibilities. In fact, going back to the 80s. So there's no basis on which we would just act on trust with them, even on the common interests that we have in the region.
Right.
Because this will do more damage, frankly, or as much damage as anything I can imagine in the Middle East. They're going to try to drag out the negotiations, the Iranians will. I don't think the administration and the Europeans want to see failed negotiations. They've got enough failures on their hands now. But we'll see very soon. It's not going to take a long time before we know what direction it's headed. And there could be serious clashes between the United States and some of its key allies over this.
Malcolm, two Jews, three opinions, one heart. Give us your final message of this very sensitive week.
just on the one heart, and I think if anybody who was at that funeral could not go away unchanged. And it reminds us that Israel values life. Our enemies value death. Israel kills when it's only when it's essential to exist. Our enemies exist to kill. And the difference in values and infrastructure, and we value all human life. We don't want to see anybody killed or dead. But when Israel has to defend itself and has to make sure that the people in the south, if you would see the fear and concern of children, some of the films of how they have to run in Sderot now, but these missiles will hit Tel Aviv ultimately. And only all of us coming together, not just in the moment of tragedy, but to stand firmly together in support of Israel, in support of our future. The lesson of all of this is that these are all of our children. These three boys are all of ours. And it's why any comments that misdirect attention or any actions, any irresponsibilities, and the idea that you can have radicals amongst the Jewish population is also something that should be of concern, because they hurt Israel's standing in the world, the standing of the Jewish people, and engage in irresponsible actions. So we have to wait and see what happened with this Arab kid. We don't know yet, and people shouldn't rush to it. But I think if all of us, if every shul this Shabbos would again think about it, and we're looking for events to do down the road now, not to lose this moment of the unity, especially during the 3 weeks, a period that has always tested the Jewish people throughout history, Achdus, the unity that we saw, is going to be more important than ever.
Oh, no question about it. Enjoy Jerusalem. We will reconvene next week. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos.
Malcolm Holine is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Friday weekly update here on this 4th of July morning at JM in the AM.